Welcome back to the Renaissance 127, Ray.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Off air, you were just talking about putting your head on Vitruvian's man's penis.
That was meant to be private, but yeah. We all have fantasy. You asked me what would I do if I had a time machine. I told you. Or we could do something different. Yeah.
Leonardo and his good friend, Francesco Di Giorgio Martini, inventor of the martini.
I knew that.
Shaken, not stirred. Loved what Vito wrote about the human body because it gave expression to an analogy that went all the way back to Plato, the relationship between man and the earth, man and the universe. The defining metaphor of the Renaissance was that man was the center of all things, that we needed to pay more attention to man, and we could understand what God wanted and how the world works by better understanding people, by focusing on ourselves for a change and learning what people need, what people want, what they look like.
Yeah.
As Francesco wrote, all the arts and all the world's rules are derived from a well-composed and proportioned human body. Man, called a little world, contains in himself all the general perfections of the whole world. And Leonardo wrote around about the same time, the ancients call man a lesser world, and certainly the use of this name is well bestowed because his body is an analogue for the world. And I think, you know, we think about this in different terms today, but, you know, you see lots of art and memes, you know, looking at the swirls of a fingerprint and the swirls of a galaxy.
Right.
You know, we look at the veins in the human body and the structure of the limbs of a tree and how they branch out.
And in marble.
There is.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. There are obviously patterns that are repeated in nature at a microcosmic level and at a macrocosmic level. The same patterns repeat because if you believe Stephen Wolfram and his book A Different Kind of Science, which came out around about the year 1999 or 2000 from memory, the universe runs on a couple of basic computational models.
Keep it simple.
And those models work, and we find them repeated everywhere we look because that's the foundational computational algorithms of the universe. And so the big thinkers in antiquity and in the Renaissance, you know, from Plato through to Leonardo and Vitruvius in between there, kind of had a sense for this, that there are patterns in man that, in their view at the time, were copied or reflected in the universe. And you could maybe... Was it? I think you sent me that new to the TikTok series of God and his assistant and all the shit that they're designing. Did you send that to me first? That's fucking great. Reminds me of the old Mr. Deity YouTube show from like 12 or 13 years ago.
Right.
Similar sort of thing. It was God being a bit of a buffoon creating shit. sort of.
Yeah.
Really, really funny. Good stuff, that.
So you said when we were doing a series on your book on the bullshit filter, you know, we're just a wave on the ocean, but to stop for a second, that also means, yes, we're just a part of something much larger than ourselves, but we're also a smaller representation or copy or have similarities with the larger universe. So if you study man, you study nature, you get the earth. And if you get the earth, you get the universe. And all that comes back to what Leonardo was saying is like, I'm not just an artist. I'm not just an architect. I'm not just an engineer. I'm all those things because all those things that I study are interrelated. And that's why I can do everything because I see the world through that viewpoint. And so, so he can excel at things because he's accepted that everything is interconnected. Don't try to divide it. Don't be a specialist in one thing. It is all interconnected. And that's what he does. And so, he and Francesco are going to love this thing because it pretty much, not that they came up with this, but it pretty much validates their point of view or their worldview and what they've been focusing all their time on. So Yeah, they were very excited about this idea.
Yeah, and there was, I think it was in Vitruvius's book I was reading when he was talking about building a location, choosing a location to build a city.
Right.
He was talking about, well, just as the human body has lots of fluids that run through it, it has blood and veins that carry it, it has excrement that needs to be removed, it has inputs and outputs. A well-designed city needs to have room for the same exact same things. It needs to have water that flows through it, like blood flows through the human body to keep everything moving. It needs to have natural ways of inputs, ports or locations where food and products can come in, like the mouth. It needs to have ways of removing the excrement. It needs to have, you know, ways to get rid of the sewage. You know, and you think about the city like a human body. And you think about all of the organism. You know, it's an organism, exactly. Yeah. And cities are organisms.
Yes.
The whole field of theory on this these days, I remember reading a book 20 years ago exactly about this, about how cities are organisms. So, yeah, Vitruvius was way ahead of his time. And, you know, Leonardo and his guys would have splooged all over this because this guy was definitely in their can. They were jerking off over this book. It was like,
They probably did. Yeah.
For them, this book was like me going to the cinema when a new Quentin Tarantino film comes out. I'm like, fucking great.
Why are you wearing that trench coat? Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it. Hand me that tissue.
Oh, my God. Great.
Oh, well, Leo needed something because at this point, Salai is only 10 years old or something. So he needs something else to get off until this boy's like 15 or 16, as we all wait for the 15-year-old. But anyway, yeah, no, they loved this idea and they pretty much made it their life's ambition to try to work this stuff out.
Speaking of Quentin Tarantino,
I
read his new novella of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Nice.
And through that, he was talking about the Matt Helm books. You ever read any of the Matt Helm books?
Give me. It sounds familiar, but I'm not sure.
What am I doing asking you? Like,
it sounds familiar.
It's not on a YouTube clip. No. So Matt Helm. There was a series of Matt Helm. There's like 100 of them.
Right.
Written by an American author. They're basically the American James Bond books.
Oh.
Came out same sort of period. Created by an author, Donald Hamilton was the writer. The first book came out in 1960. 27 novels, Matt Helm novels he wrote.
Wow.
And Tarantino talks about it in the book, and it's also mentioned in the film because Sharon Tate starred in a Matt Helm film, The Wrecking Crew, that starred Dean Martin. Dean Martin made a bunch of Matt Helm films in the 60s.
Wow.
But the films are apparently spoofs. They're spy spoofs.
Right.
With, you know, I haven't seen them, but, you know, that they're comedies. Better.
Yes.
Dean
yes.
Martin comedies. But the books aren't. And in Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood book, he makes this distinction. He said, no, the movies were terrible, but the books are fantastic.
Right.
So, you know, recommendation from Quentin, I had to go. So I went and bought the first Matt Helm book, Death of a Citizen, the one that came out in 1960. And I'm about halfway through it. It's really good. Really good.
Nice.
I mean, I'd kind of heard of the character and I kind of knew of the films, but I didn't really know about the books, and so it was sort of a revelation for me. So nice. Check it out if you like good sort of Bondy kind of book. Very different to Bond, though. The first book starts off, Matt Helm was an assassin, part of this international group of assassins during World War II. He's been retired for 15 years by 1960. Married, kids, wife doesn't know anything about his other life.
Right. Yeah.
And he's now he's a novelist now, writing sort of westerns and some renown. And he's at some high society party in, I don't know, Washington. No, where is he? He's Boston or somewhere like that, he is, with his wife. And he sees a woman across the room. That he, another assassin that he used to work with 15 years ago, and he had a little fling with her, hasn't seen her for 15 years. And he's like, oh, holy shit, well, I didn't expect to see her again. I guess I better go up and do the right thing and say hello. And he walks towards her and she gives him the signal. No, don't approach. I'll make contact later.
I get that a lot. Yeah.
But for different reasons. So he gets pulled back into the game. And I was talking to Tony about this. Tony said that all the he's seen the films. He said all the films are like that too. He's trying to get out, and they keep dragging him back into the spy or the sort of the assassin game.
It's not John Wick, it's an assassin. And Nobody, the movie. Is it Nobody?
Yeah. Have you seen that?
No, I'm still. I'm saving it for the beach. Yeah.
Oh, so good. So good.
I'm looking forward to it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean. Anyway.
Yes. Sorry.
Vitruvius's descriptions of human proportions inspired Leonardo and his friends to compile a similar set of measurements. Leonardo had started his anatomy studies in 1489, just before he went to Pavia, where they got their hands on a copy of Vitruvius for the first time.
Right.
And this whole idea that proportion and harmony and symmetry are central to designing things became kind of central to Leonardo's worldview as well from this point on.
Right.
And as far as we know, no one of any note had made a serious and precise drawing of the dimensions of the body along the lines that Vitruvius had mentioned in the 1500 years since his book had been first published.
Don't you find Leonardo that amazing?
And his friend, yes, it is amazing, yes. But of course, well, yes and no. I mean,
the book had been lost for...
Well, maybe no one ever read it. No one cared about it
too
much
busy
in Rome.
The Bible. Right.
No, in ancient Rome, they were too busy, you know.
Gotcha.
I don't know. Doing shit. You know, we know because of our Caesar series, not a lot of great art of any form came out of the Julio-Claudian period.
Right. Mostly there's functional architecture.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had Ovid very early on and those guys. We had a couple of poets. We had, who wrote the fucking Aeneid? Virgil. We had Virgil. We had Ovid. You know, we had some dirty poetry. But then, and that was early on, and then it kind of disappears. And you know, from late Augustus, the late Augustan period, on through Tiberius, Caligula, Claudius, Nero.
Things got tricky.
There's no art
to
speak of. They love their theatre, but there's not a single great playwright, poet, sculptor, painter that has really come down to us from this period. Now, people were doing that stuff. We know that Rome was covered in sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
We know that it was covered in art. Some of it was brought in from Egypt and Greece and that kind of stuff, but they were getting their own stuff done.
Right.
But, you know, there's not a big name that has survived from that period. We don't go, yes, of course, under Claudius there was this guy, or under Augustus there was that guy. No, we know Agrippa. They built a ton of shit, but who are the architects who built all of these temples? Who are the sculptors who did all the sculpting? You know, what there are names, but not a lot of great stuff happened in that sense that we remember. Yeah.
What does that tell you about Rome? You know, Augustus reigns for a long time. Then comes Tiberius, the seat warmer. You know, I don't know. Yeah.
Well, part of it is, of course, not a lot of literature survives from that period. There would have been a ton of literature. It would have all been in the Library of Alexandria.
Right.
Probably the Library of Alexandria would have told us all this stuff. We would have known who all of these, you know, writers and sculptors and artists and stuff were. Yeah. But everything got lost. You know, I think the figure that I've quoted before is that about 1% of literature from the period of Caesar has survived, and most of that is Cicero. You know, but from the Augustan period and beyond, the Julio-Claudian period, we have Seneca, you know, and then later on, post-Julio-Claudian period, we've got the guys that we use as our sources, right? Mm-hmm. We've got Tacitus, we've got Suetonius, we've got Lives of the Twelve Caesars and all this sort of stuff. But we don't have a lot of stuff about contemporary life. The sciences, the arts, architecture didn't survive. The Christians who took over just didn't keep copies of it. I mean, stuff got destroyed in the Library of Alexandria. But, you know, as we've talked about in the early part of this series, during the Dark Ages, you know, you had limited number of literate people.
Mm-hmm.
You had limited number of scriptorums.
Good point,
Vellum. Just not paper.
Yeah.
Well, paper had disappeared because, you know, the relationship between the western part of the empire and Egypt had broken down after the dissolution of the empire, so you couldn't get your papyrus from Egypt. So there wasn't a lot of paper. Writing stuff on skins, vellum and that kind of stuff was very time-consuming and expensive. You had to clean the skin. Originally, you had to prepare it, or if you were using an old one, you had to clean it. That was time-consuming and expensive and difficult. So you only had a limited number of materials, and it took a lot of time and a lot of effort to copy a book. So what are you going to copy? Are you going to copy the Bible, or are you going to copy, you know, some fucking dude's treatise on how to build a nude woman in a sculpture? Well, you're not going to do that.
That's how you mix sand and
No one gives a shit about that. Let's copy the Bible, the Church Fathers, and that kind of stuff. Commentaries on the Bible.
So
these things just disappeared over time. But the point is that we don't know of anything that existed in that period. No, there might have been drawings, but we don't know about them. But anyway, whatever the reason, Leonardo and his friends decided they'd have a crack.
Right.
Now, Francesco.
Right.
Sorry, you were going to say something.
No, I just wanted to emphasize, you said this, but I want to emphasize it. So 1490, they're going to get around to, let's tackle this because they've gotten the book, from Pavia. But the year before, when Leo started doing his detailed intents, the way he always does everything, when he was studying anatomy and proportions, that's going to come directly into play because they're all going to give I'm sure they had tons of conversation about it, but everybody's going to try it on their own. And so, but the point is Leo's got this other advantage, whereas he's been in his own detailed way examining the proportions of the body, the human body, the bones, the skulls. We'll get into all that stuff later. So he's got a very intense working knowledge of the body, and that's going to come into play with what he's about to do.
Yeah. So Francesco did three drawings based on Vitruvius's description of the perfect body that have survived.
Yeah, yeah.
None of them are particularly impressive in terms of art. They're kind of rough sketches kind of thing.
Right, but you bring up a good question. Is it supposed to be art, or is it supposed to be conveying an idea that someone wrote about 1500 years ago? Does it have to be beautiful, or is it better if it's not beautiful and it's functional to help the person focus on what you're trying to convey? Because you're right. The first one was rather casual. There was no proportions. The other two were more carefully drawn, and there was groups of circles and squares in there. So he tries harder on the second and third, but it's certainly not a thing of beauty or what we would consider to be art.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're right. And what Francesco was trying to do was, you know, he's trying to talk about science and he's trying to display it visually because he and Leonardo both believed that it was easier to convey scientific ideas through visualizing them.
Absolutely.
Kind of a breakthrough idea. It's easier to understand something if you can see it as well as read it and listen to it. And at the same time that they were working on it, another one of Leonardo's friends seems to have been trying to draw this as well. His name was Giacomo Andrea.
Mm-hmm.
He was part of sort of the group of architects and engineers that were working in Milan for Ludovico Sforza. And it was Andrea who had the dinner party that we have previously mentioned where 10-year-old Sally, who'd only been Da Vinci's assistant for 2 days, broke shit and spilled the wine. God. Now, that dinner took place on June 24th, 1490, 4 weeks after Leonardo and Francesco got back from Pavia.
Right.
And so they're obviously, you know, just all talking about Vitruvius.
Yes.
They probably shared what they'd learned and the copies of what they brought back with Andrea.
Yeah.
So this dinner party, you know, you get a TARDIS, you go back to this dinner party. These guys are all
going on
about Vitruvius.
Where's the napkin? Like, give me a napkin. Here's what I got. Hours, but which is why the 10-year-old started breaking shit and spilling wine, because he's bored to tears. You don't bring a 10-year-old to an intellectual discussion. Yeah. That's
unless he has an iPad with Minecraft on it. Like,
then you're golden.
Don't try that.
Then you're golden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, Leonardo, after that dinner, he invented the iPad and Minecraft. Just to distract 10-year-olds everywhere from dinner parties.
We're eternally grateful. Yeah.
Giacomo Andrea, by the way, would end up being killed, beheaded and quartered.
Yes.
By French troops when they captured Milan 9 years later.
It turns out the French aren't really keen on people that plot against them, and Andrea was plotting against them. Leonardo wasn't. We'll get into that later. But on May 12th, the year 1500, Andrea is killed and his body is quartered. And I guess they took it to different parts of the city. I'm not sure, but that's a message. Don't fuck with the French when they're in control, and don't plot against them. So he comes to an unfortunate end.
Yeah, but it's interesting that he was very loyal to Ludovico Sforza, apparently. And so after the French took Milan, he plotted against them. Leonardo was still there.
Right.
And instead of plotting against the French on behalf of Sforza, the guy that really, the first guy that took him seriously and gave him work, he said, all right, well, welcome to the new boss, same as the old boss. And just went to work for the French and survived.
Yes. Thank you. Yeah. I stand on my principles. Okay, you're dead. I shove my principles up my ass. You can live a little longer. Thank you, sir. May I have another? So, lesson learned.
Leonardo's principles were surviving.
Exactly. Mission accomplished.
Surviving. Yeah, I don't really care. Sforza. Yeah.
Just pay me.
Sforza is his slogan.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, and shortly after the death of Andrea, Leonardo went hunting for Andrea's copy of Vitruvius. Apparently, he managed to get a full version of it.
Is that wrong?
And
your good friend dies and you're like, oh, where's his books? Where's his books? Yeah, no, I miss it. I miss it. You see the tear? Where's his books?
Well, it could have been he wanted a memento.
There we go. I should have led with that.
Of him.
You know what would really...
It was, you know, they studied it together.
He would have wanted to have it.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to believe that Leonardo didn't have his own copy at this stage, because he was well off. At this stage, we know he didn't care about money and he gave it all away, but I'm sure he had a pretty impressive library of good quality books.
Yeah.
We know he had a copy of Alberti's book on architecture. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming he had one of Vitruvius as well. Anyway, there is an entry in one of his notebooks. He says, Messer Vincenzo Aleprando, who lives near the Inn of the Bear, has Giacomo Andrea's Vitruvius. He maybe just wanted to find out what happened to it, make sure it was in good hands. Now, in the 1980s,
the second greatest generation of music. Sorry, go ahead.
In the 1980s, Andrea's drawing of Vitruvius's man was rediscovered.
Nice.
Along with the copy of Vitruvius, there's an architectural historian who also is relatively young. I looked him up, Claudio Sciarbi.
Right.
He found a heavily illustrated manuscript copy of Vitruvius's books on architecture sitting in an archive, miscatalogued.
Ah.
in Ferrara in Italy, and worked out that it was the manuscript that had been compiled by Giacomo Andrea. It has 127 illustrations in it, and one of those was Andrea's version of Vitruvian Man. Now,
yes,
this is really important because compared to the ones that Francesco did,
right,
Andrea's is very, very similar to Leonardo's. Did you look at the two of them side by side?
Yes, I got them right here. Ah, yeah. Yeah. He's got his arms out, but his feet are together. Anyway, yeah, but it's very basic. Yeah.
Very, very similar to Leonardo's, less detailed, right, but the approach and the dimensions are almost identical, which leads Sciarbi to believe that Da Vinci and Andrea probably worked on it together. They probably tried to figure out the best way of drawing this. Maybe Andrea did his version first and Leonardo copied from his version.
Yeah.
Or because we don't really know, we don't have a date
right
on Leonardo's version. It's assumed that it's around 1490, but we don't really know. It could have been 1500 after Andrea died and he got a copy of his book and he got a copy of his drawing and he went, oh, okay. Yeah. We don't really know when he did it.
Right.
But Leonardo's is obviously by far the most impressive version of it, which is why it is the most famous drawing in the world.
Yeah. Well, I find it interesting because we know or we can guess that they were talking about this subject over the dinner, and I'm sure they were talking about this in Ludovico's court. I'm sure they were talking about it every chance they got. So there's a lot of information going back and forth, but you know everybody is going to end up at some point drawing their own version of it, just like you were talking about there. But of course, when Leonardo does it, he's going to Leo the hell out of it. It's going to be well thought out. It's going to be detailed. It's going to be so much more than what it needs to be, because that's how he does everything. But you're right, he does start to sit down, he plans this thing out, and he starts working on his, and like you just said, it is going to be so much more than it has to be, and it is going to be so much more precise and beautiful than the other two gentlemen's drawings, because that's the way he does everything. Attention to detail.
Like his version of Naked Guy Doing Jumping Jacks, as one author I read called it.
Right.
In terms of its scientific and artistic precision, it's just so far above everything else. It's crazy.
Yeah,
it's almost like, I feel like Leonardo saw Andrea's version and just went, okay, oh, holy shit, that's awful. Somebody hold my beer.
Here's what I don't do. I don't do that. No offense, Andrea. I love you like a brother, but that's a form of what not to do. But you know, Leo probably spent, I don't know how much time, because you know how he is in his own head. He probably just sat there and he just thought about it for a while and he was just doing a mental map. And then he's like, okay, I'm ready. But you know, he planned this thing out before he touched a piece of paper.
Yeah, of course. Now, the original version of Leonardo's drawing is in the Galleria dell'Accademia in Venice. It's kept in a locked room on the fourth floor. You have to be, if you want to see it, you have to do it by appointment. And, you know, you're very lucky if you get to see it. You have to schedule it months in advance.
It's us.
Yeah, well, definitely. Obviously, they're going to let us see it.
Right.
But I'm talking about the plebs out there who aren't world famous Renaissance podcasters.
Right. Gotcha.
Now, unlike the other drawings of this, this isn't a rough sketch. He's made it with a metal point pen. Walter Isaacson says he got to see it close up. He said when you do that, you can see the indentations made by the stylus of Leonardo's metal point pen and the 12 pricks made by the point of his compass, as well as Vitruvian Man's prick. Where we're going to put your head on the coffee mug version of this, we decided.
Right. If you wanted to sell, that's
now,
what you do.
Just to remind people about the metal point pen, metal point or silver point pen was how they drew in these days, because they didn't have pencils. So you'd have a silver rod or a wire that would be dragged across a surface that had been prepared with some sort of a primer. So you would be, you know, dragging the primer off of it rather than drawing onto it.
Oh, scratching it off or something.
Now, it's a scratch. But, you know, so if you fuck it up, very hard. You can't rub it out. It's a scratch. Oh, it's there. Yeah.
Start over. Yeah, yeah. Another page.
Now, they would sometimes do them on wax or on bark or on parchment or prepared paper. But I think this is a major failing and a complaint I have with Leonardo. Like, why didn't he invent the pencil?
Right.
Like, surely Leonardo at some point must have gone, oh, this is fucking ridiculous. Why are we still scratching stuff
put
off?
Something
this
on
is
the
ridiculous.
Paper. Yeah, what the fuck? Yeah. On the paper. Yeah.
Like, all of the stuff he could invent, he didn't invent the pencil? Imagine how much money he would have made. Matt, we wouldn't call them pencils. We'd call them Leonardos now. Can you...
Leos. Leonardo.
Can you sharpen
Leonardo
I can
borrow?
Leonardo for me? I mean, that's... Yeah. You know, really.
Hey, the tip of your Leo is getting dull.
You might think he's famous
right?
now, but if he'd actually given a shit...
Oh, if he'd listened to us.
Fucking us.
Yeah.
He would have... Did something. And you know, you don't need... It's not like building a ballast day. You know, it's not a... Anyone can do this. I could have invented the pencil.
Wood and
if
graphite.
I was back then, I'm pretty confident.
Hell yeah.
I can say with some level of assuredness that I would have invented the pencil. I would have gone, this is fucking bullshit. Like, I invented podcasting.
Okay. Here
like,
we go.
You know, I didn't just sit there and go... You know, radio's
nice
boring. I just,
something.
You know, sat down and invented podcasting. And then I invented history podcasting and Skype recording. Because I'm the Leonardo da Vinci of podcasting.
Right.
But I actually did shit. Yeah, didn't just talk about it, draw pictures of it. I could have drawn a picture of you and I in front of a microphone. No, I went out there and did something about it.
Yeah.
Unlike Leonardo da Vinci.
Damn right.
Lazy,
you're damn right.
Lazy,
so if I could go,
motherfucker,
lazy. Shit.
By the way, just before we move on from Metal Point, it was in Cumbria in England in the sort of 1500s, early 1500s, where they discovered massive graphite deposits, and they were like, "Oh, you know what? We could do
we
something with
this."
And that's sort of what ended.
Well, the kids were taking graphite rocks and doing graffiti all over the fucking town. Your mom sucks, I should know. You know, that kind of thing. And so, no, there's got to be a better use for this.
Leonardo.
So if I could change
Leonardo
my answer.
Leonardo was around then. He should have been the guy that went and discovered that, commissioned it. You know, commissioned people to go out and find graphite for his new invention.
What's he doing?
Resting on his laurels. Lazy motherfucker, Leonardo da Vinci. You look up lazy motherfucker in the dictionary, that's what you see is a photo of Leonardo da Vinci.
It's a him. Ironically, drawn in pencil, and he's got a real, like, a frown, like, I'm sorry, you're right, I should have done better. No, so if we could go back in time, let's not visit Jesus or kill Hitler or go to the dinner party where Salai was spilling shit. Let's go back and we'll invent the pencil. Fucking Rich's guy. Yeah. It'll be awesome.
What are we calling it? If we invent it? That's Barry and Stan's.
Oh, God. Well, you've got the camera. You've got the Ray Cam.
Well, considering that it's...
Cam sharp point.
Considering that it's...
Right.
That's small and thin and pointy, I think we go with the Radix. We'll just call them Radix.
As long as I get 50% of all the money that's made from pencil sold, I'll be okay. I'll get therapy to deal with my small penis. But anyway, on a side note, we know that Leonardo stuck his compass in and we're at the naval, you know, we're about to go into this, but he stuck his compass in and he drove around. The compass was invented 2,000 years before then during the Han Dynasty in China. It was first mentioned as far as being used in Western Europe in 1190. So, let's show a little respect for the Chinese for once again coming up with something amazing. So good for them. But anyway, I just sidebar.
So Da Vinci used a compass and a set square. He drew the circle and the square and then allowed the man's feet to rest on the bottom of both of them. Now, this is where it's interesting and where it maps up with Andrea's drawing. As per Vitruvius's description, the man's navel is at the precise center of the circle, but his genitals are at the center of the square.
Here we go.
Now, in one of the notes that Da Vinci drew on the page, he says that, sort of describing the positioning of the man, if you open your legs enough that your head is lowered by 1/14th of your height, kind of reminds me of what you first said to me in Vegas. If you open your legs enough that your head is lowered, I can get into...
We can get started. Right. Because we're wasting time.
And this blue pill is going to wear off after about 4 hours. So,
that's
you know.
Right. And I'm going to get my money's worth. And then we got to go back down to the craps table. But anyway.
If you open your legs enough that your head is lowered by 1/14th of your height and raise your hands enough that your extended fingers touch the line of the top of your head, know that the center of the extended limbs will be the navel, and the space between the legs will be an equilateral triangle.
So is his drawing, does his drawing match one of the other two gentlemen where, I'm trying to think here. I know that the circle is going to be taller and stick out further than the square, but I was trying to think how come, was it only Leonardo that lined up? Because here's what I'm trying to get at, and I apologize. When Vitruvius was writing, he never said anything about drawing this out. He never said anything about superimposing a picture of a man in a square and a man in a circle. He never said anything about superimposing him. He never said anything about taking the man in the circle, I think, and spread his legs out a little bit so he's a little lower. So for a second, forget the circle, forget the square. If you draw them separately, superimpose them, then... because it's all about the man being the center, being the microcosm of the universe. I was just wondering, how did anybody else come up with the idea of spreading the legs to drop the man a little bit down in the circle?
See, the problem that other artists had when they tried to do this is that Vitruvius's description said that the navel lies in the middle of the crown and the soles of the feet, but it actually doesn't. Right. If you measure the distance between the two, it's not actually in the center. But what Leonardo figured was, if you spread your legs, then it is in the center. So
how to make it work.
Gotcha. Exactly. Yeah. Also, the whole thing, what other artists tried to do was try and get the dimensions of the square and the dimension of the circle, like the height of the square and the height of the circle and the width of two, to be the same, and get the body to fit in. And it didn't work. Now, as you pointed out, and Leonardo and Andrea worked out, Vitruvius never actually said that the dimensions of the circle and the square had to be the same. And so,
The area is not going to be the same.
So, in their drawings, and this is why they think they... did them at the same time, or Leonardo copied off of Andrea, or maybe vice versa. Although you have to think that if Andrea saw Leonardo's drawing, he'd go, I'm not touching that. Why would you look at that and go, no, I think I can I can do better than that. No. Even me with my abnormal levels of narcissistic arrogance wouldn't look at Da Vinci's and go,
I think I can do
better than that. You'd be going, okay, that's done. Yeah. That's done. Yeah. Yeah. Put a fork in it. Yeah. That's done.
Put a pin in it. Nope. Yeah. Yeah. But yeah, that's absolutely. And because we're going to see in another example in just a minute, Leonardo wasn't afraid to go, okay, Vitruvius, I see what you write, but I'm not going to strictly adhere to it because you can't square a circle. The areas, it just doesn't work because of pi. And so I'm going to interpret what you said, but I'm going to bring my own experience into this drawing.
Yeah, so he writes down on the page all of his notes about the proportions of the body, and he says he got them from Vitruvius, but he didn't.
No. He improved.
More than
To put it bluntly,
to give him credit, like Alberti said, "Oh, Vitruvius is full of shit. I can do better." Leonardo said, "No, I got this all from Vitruvius. I got it all from you." When really, at least more than half of the measurements that he has on the page are his own. They're not from Vitruvius. Yes. For example, Vitruvius puts the height of a man at 6 times the length of his foot, but Leonardo says it's 7 times the length of a foot.
Right. So he didn't just take Vitruvius's word for it. He's like, Sly, bring me my special pine ruler that shows 6 inches of foot. I don't know. But anyway, so no, he literally studied himself. He measured himself and he checked everything. He wasn't just going to assume that this guy from 1500 years ago got everything perfectly right. That's not who Leo is.
So, and you know, this being a sketch in a notebook, like he wasn't, this isn't a commission. He's not doing this on the wall of a monastery or something that's Fox's court. This is just him fucking around in a notebook, although we know that he would probably use his notebook as a thing to show people, hey, sit down, take a look.
I worked on this last night.
Yeah, fuck it. Knocked it out in 30 seconds, really. Like, it's nothing. I'm that good. I did it with my feet.
I'm Leo, bitch.
Feet. That's how good I am. While I was getting a blowjob from Sally. Like, that's how good I am.
Yeah. It's a Tuesday.
Yeah, it's a
fucking
Tuesday
night.
I'm Da Vinci. Yeah. Dap me up.
Yeah. Did he draw a stick man? I would have drawn a stick man. I'm guessing he didn't draw a stick man.
No, he didn't draw a stick man. Like, obviously, everyone's seen this, but I encourage everyone listening to this, not while you're driving, but...
please don't. Whip it out when you can.
And have a look. I'll put a link to it, a high-res version, on our website, if I remember, or on Facebook. But have a look and really, really, really look at it and think about what you're looking at. You know, he uses lots of shading, delicate lines. Now, you know, when you look at what stands out from this, I don't know about you, but the head is incredible.
Oh, magnificent.
Detail. Got an intense stare and curls, curly hair that...
I'm turned on.
Scholars tend to think is probably a self-portrait. If you remember the painting that Bramante did of Heraclitus and Democritus, that we assume one of them is based on Bramante himself, the other character is based on Da Vinci, this character looks a lot like that painting, the Heraclitus in that painting. So, probably a self-portrait of Da Vinci. He was about 38 years old at the time. We know from descriptions that we've got from people like Vasari that he had a beautifully proportioned body. He was very fit and muscular and beautiful. So, a typical podcaster body.
Yeah,
he's standing in the mirror. Thinking about inventing pencils and drawing himself. Like, I mean, I don't know about you, but I get naked and stare at myself in the mirror all the time.
Right before the show. right before I record. That's how I set myself up. Where I put my underwear? Shit. Okay, we're about to be online.
Oh, you're wearing underwear today?
No.
That's something.
I like to break it up. I like to break it up.
So it's drawn on a sheet of paper about 13.5 by 9 5/8 inches, a little bit larger than a standard piece of modern letter paper. Now, what jumps out at you, Ray, when you look at the picture? You tell me yours and I'll tell you mine.
Right. Well, first of all, if you look at his left eye, it's shaded in because, again, he didn't have to do this, but it's very detailed. It's got, like you said, the lines are beautiful and it's got shading. Anyway, so his left eye looks shaded to the point where it could almost be an eye patch. So basically, he's a naked pirate trying to wave me down because he thinks I've stolen his map to his golden treasure. No, the head, the face, the scowl, the look, I really do think he was looking into a mirror as he was drawing this, and maybe he wasn't quite that happy with the fact that, you know, I'm getting older and Celia is still a young pup. But no, just the head and the expression in the face, I cannot describe that. I cannot do it injustice, but it is absolutely amazing.
I'll tell you what I think about that eye. Yeah. The right eye on the page, right. But his left eye, I guess, it's a Terminator eye.
Fuck me, yeah. You're right.
It's either bionics.
Yeah.
He's either the $6 million man, he's Steve Austin.
Yeah.
Or it's a Terminator. So I think this is evidence that Terminators, before they sent the Terminator back to 1985,
time travel.
They sent one back to 1490, realized it was too early. And they fucked up with their coordinates when they sent him back.
But before he left, Leonardo got a quick drawing of him in one of his sketchbooks hanging from his belt and then was able to incorporate it in here. So that to me makes more sense than anything else I've heard
all year. I know. Yep. I'm just dropping truth bombs on everyone here about...
But I love
the thing that really jumps out at me here, apart from the face, is the shading and the source of light. Now, if you look carefully, you'll notice that the right side of the hair, as you look at it, or the left side of his body, but the right side as you look at it, the hair is less detailed than the left. The shading on the left armpit, as we look at it, on the left side of the page. Is more, he's giving it depth perception, even though it's a, two-dimensional drawing, really. He's taken the effort to shade it in to give us a sense of a light source on coming from the right side of the page. It's also with the eyes you mentioned before. The details of the muscles and also the shading on the neck and the face that just gives it that stern look. The guy is sort of frowning. He's not smiling. He's not neutral. He's definitely
he's not happy.
He's not a happy man.
Yeah.
This is a fierce warrior face. Yes. This is an angry. This isn't Jesus.
Right.
He's not Jesus. Maybe it's the real Messiah. This is the warrior king version of the Messiah that's coming to kick ass, man. This guy.
Straighten these motherfuckers
up. With the curly hair also reminds me of Alexander. Alexander never got that old, but if he had lived this long, it could have been Alexander the Great.
Yes. Because he'd have scars and it would be pretty intense. He literally looks like he could step off the page. That's what I was trying to think of. He's that detailed. He literally looks like he could just walk off the page. Like you said, the shadow, the shading and everything else, it looks like a real person standing.
Now, you mentioned the wonky foot before. Now, people who don't have it in front of them, just to remind you of what it looks like. Yeah, there's almost two versions of the guy superimposed one over the other. In one version, he's got his hands straight out, 90-degree angles, and his feet are together, his legs together. The other one, he's got his legs spread and his arms tilted up, so his tip of his middle finger is even with the top of his head. Now, I said before that when your legs are together, your navel isn't at the center of your body. Leonardo's only got one navel here, so he's somehow managed to make this work without looking particularly weird. The other thing that pops out is that left foot. My left foot. There's a whole film made about this many years ago, and it's turned to the side, which looks uncomfortable, almost like his leg's broken. And apparently, that is as a guide, as a reference guide to the length of a foot, is why he's done that.
Right.
So
beauty and accuracy.
Yeah. Well, yes. You see that just below the drawing, he's actually got a little measurement guide there, so you can see the measurement units that he's using. And he's got the measurement right. of a foot represented by the foot. There do seem to be, there does seem to be like a second line underneath the foot uses a reference guide. Mm-hmm. But so if you want to check his measurements, you can use that sideways turned foot to check the rest of the dimensions on it. He's also segmented. If you look just below the knees, he's drawn a line just right. Where the legs join right across the guy's balls. Mm-hmm. He's drawn a line there, the top of his nutsack. Yeah. At his shoulders, at his elbows, at his wrists, he's segmented there. Across the sternum, but across the nipples, there's a line. Across his shoulders, there's a line. So you can see at where he's measured this to attune to Vitruvius's and his own observations. It's very, very meticulously done. According to Toby Lester, it's an idealized self-portrait in which Leonardo, stripped down to his essence, takes his own measure, and in doing so embodies a timeless human hope that we just might have the power of mind to figure out how we fit into the grand scheme of things. Think of the picture as an act of speculation, a kind of metaphysical self-portrait in which Leonardo, as an artist, a natural philosopher, and a stand-in for all of humanity, peers at himself with furrowed brow and tries to grasp the secrets of his own nature.
Yeah, and remember, he's not literally trying to square a circle. It's a metaphorical solution to the Vitruvius problem. Basically, you've got your circle, you've got your square, but more important than that, you've got the human who is representing all of nature, the world, the universe, because we're just a part of it. So again, it was a physical representation of what Vitruvius wrote 1,500 years ago. And it's a thing
of beauty. So I wanted to ask you about it. Like, why do you think the drawing is so popular? Why is it the most popular drawing in the world?
Oh. First of all, the penis, I would think, would be... You mean like if someone... if someone looked at it and had no idea what it represents? I don't know. It's very captivating. And again, the expression, the face, the hair, it's very intense. It just draws you in. And it's perfectly proportional. It's balanced, which of course pleases a certain part of the brain when something's proportional balanced. I don't know. It's just very intense and beautiful all at the same time. What about you?
Yeah, look, I think there's something noble about it. He depicts man, and the same could have been done for a woman. And in fact, I'd prefer it if it was a woman.
Sure. Absolutely.
Maybe we can get one of our audience members to model for it.
Or just send us some nudes and we will draw it from there.
Yeah. Send us a photo of you fully clothed first and then we'll tell you whether or not.
Right. A before and after.
Oh, non off.
I love those. Right.
Yes. Whether or not he sort of depicts man as a work of mathematics. There is something sort of precise about it. It suggests to me that man is sort of connected to the underlying forces of the universe. Just the use of the circle and the square and the way the body fits in with those dimensions. I think that would have struck a chord with religious folks down through the ages, as Vitruvius's original writings obviously did. And it also connects to those of us that are more scientifically minded. In the simplest possible way, the drawing suggests that we are somehow connected to the underlying forces of the universe, I think, whether it's religious or a secular scientific approach that you take to that. And of course, that plays into my Three Illusions book that you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't go as far as putting man in the center of the cosmos. There are lots of earlier drawings from the Middle Ages where you see man in the circle of the stars and all of this kind of stuff. He's not going overboard and filling it full of theological, I don't know, symbolism and assumptions.
Right.
It's it, getting back to Dieter Rams, I mean, from Braun, this whole idea that good design is as little design as possible, that's what I get out of this. Like, this is so beautifully simple, but perfectly executed, and has these layers of symbolism in it that are a little bit obscure and yet seem to connect at a like it connects to us, I think, in the same way that staring into a fire, a campfire, or a fireplace,
mesmerizing,
or just closing your eyes and listening to the sound of the ocean or the wind through the trees or something like that does to us. You know, those things connect to us at a subconscious level, because for the vast majority of human history, hundreds of thousands of years, our ancestors stared into fires every night. They listened to the ocean. They listened to the wind. That's a deep, deep, deep part of how our brains evolved, was to appreciate those things and connect with those things. There's something about this drawing, I think, that does the same thing. I think anyone who looks at this, whether you care about art or science or philosophy or history or not, you would have to be a broken fucking human being to look at this and not go, fuck, that's wow, holy shit, that's something, right? It does. It just it connects somehow to something deep inside of us, and I can't really articulate what it is for me, except that it's something about maths and science and humans and the nature of existence. I think somehow for me this is like the perfect symbolization, apart from the old picture of the atom, which I really like, from the 50s, the old atomic model. Well, I get a lot of joy out of that. This is probably the perfect symbolization of man and his place in the universe.
Let me try to take another stab at that, because I read somewhere that obviously when Leonardo is planning this out and he's talking to his friends and he's drawing this, he's got a lot of influences. He's got all of his experience. He's got all these different ideas from the Renaissance that's going, obviously flourishing throughout Italy. And one of them was the Neoplatonism. And there was a theory, and stop me if we talked about this, I honestly can't remember. There's a theory, a part of that called the Great Chain of Being. And this is a belief that says there's a hierarchy, like a chain, picture a chain going from north to south. At the top of the chain is a god or the gods, whatever you believe in. And at the bottom of it is devils or demons or something like that. And in between, you've got, you know, planets and animals and stuff like that. And right in the exact center of this line or this chain is a human, because we have the body of an animal, and yet we have the supposedly immortal soul of a god. So we're right there where we're supposed to be. Now, remember, I guess this was months ago when we talked about Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, who died in 1494. He was saying humans shouldn't be on that chain, because we have the unique ability to take any position we want. If we want to be good, if we want to be godlike, we can be nice to each other and we can move up the chain. If we want to be dicks, we can move down the chain and be like animals. However, for some of the priests, their answer was that God wanted to create an animal that could understand and appreciate the simple and complex of the universe that he created, so he created human. So some people would say that this drawing represents so much, obviously, like you were just saying, but one, it represents that man is a microcosm of the earth, of the universe, of the entire, of everything. And at the same time, we do have the power to decide our own fate. And when you take that and you mix it with Lucretius, that, and if you leave God out for a second, there is no meaning to life. It is literally whatever you make it. We are free to be whatever we want. We just have to have the courage to move forward and to do that. So again, this man and this drawing is a man, but he's so much more than a man. And one of the most powerful things about him is he can be good or he can be bad. It's his choice. And when I look at this, I'm like, yeah, this is a very powerful thing. And we were, you know, meant to rule over the animals. And so he has the freedom to do whatever he wants with his life, but half the human, or a lot of humans, don't even know that they have that freedom. That's kind of another thing that I got out of this drawing.